Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Welcome to the Little Friday edition. Yeah, Thursday is here on Bloomberg Radio, satellite radio channel 121. We're always on Bloomberg Originals now and, of course, on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Business News Live if you want to join us here in the studio. There's nothing on the president's schedule today. He's got a quiet little Friday, at least so far. We know that can change. And we've got our eyes on Truth Social because, well, more letters could be going out this, what is this, day after what was deadline day. Yeah, it's the 10th of July, and we've got a new deadline, as we've discussed, when it comes to trade, August 1. A whole bunch of letters dropped yesterday, and it's interesting the way this all works, because we keep seeing the form letters, you know, they just change the number, change the name at the top, maybe the number in the copy. But the one that went to Brazil certainly got some attention yesterday, as the president not only slaps a 50% tariff on goods coming in from Brazil, but goes on a long missive. And it's not just Truth Social. It's actually in the letter about former President Bolsonaro, the censorship of American social media and so forth, making many wonder exactly what is driving the trade policy in this White House. Is this getting a little personal? Mike Pence talked about it today, the trade policy, that is. You see Mike Pence on Bloomberg surveillance, the former vice president, of course, has been making the media rounds, has a lot of nice things to say most recently about this second Trump administration when it comes to the big, beautiful bill, when it comes to strikes against Iran. Not so much tariffs. Here's Mike Pence from this morning.
What we saw several months ago, now it's paused again, happily, is the kind of broad-based industrial policy that I think ultimately will harm the American economy. What I like to say is free trade with free nations, be tough on China, be tough on trade abusers, but have the objective of ultimately lowering trade barriers. And that's how America wins and prospers.
Free to be you and me. The old Republican is coming out of the former governor of Indiana, longtime Congressman Mike Pence. Interesting. Reflecting with the old line in the Republican Party, which, of course, had an allergy to tariffs. Then again, Mike Pence seems to think tariffs worked all right the way they did it, surgically speaking, strategically in the first administration. This across-the-board throwing of darts and now adding personal affections to tariff decisions is making everybody wonder, and it certainly is making Wall Street skip a little bit of a beat today. You heard from Charlie Pellett. This isn't a massive sell-off here, but maybe a little pause in the rally. Now, we want to get to all of this and what this means for what will be our future trade relations with countries around the world by the 1st of August, not to mention what's happening elsewhere when it comes to foreign policy in this White House. With a great voice of experience working out of the newsroom here in Washington, D.C., that's Jenny Welch, Bloomberg Economics Chief Geoeconomics Analyst, a veteran of the Biden White House. And Jenny, it's great to have you with us here, as always, on Balance of Power here on Bloomberg. What do you make specifically of the Brazil letter? The fact that he's calling out a former president who's facing charges over an attempted coup. This is giving the market some agita here to think that Donald Trump is capable maybe of more than some thought when it comes to throwing tariffs around. Jenny, how do you see it?
Thanks, Joe. Well, as you noted, this letter stands out from the others in that he's taking aim at Brazil over political issues. Certainly, we've seen the Trump administration criticize other countries for their handling of political leaders who share some of the same politics as President Trump. But this is the first time he's used the cudgel of tariffs to sort of reinforce those threats or that criticism. I also suspect this isn't just about former President Bolsonaro, but might reflect on Trump's criticism of the BRICS, which held their summit over the weekend. Afterwards, he saw him lob threats at the BRICS and partners associated with it over what he characterized as anti-American policies. Well, Brazil was the host country for the BRICS and is largely supportive of some of those policies that I think President Trump criticized as being anti-American. I think a lot remains to be seen in how this feud plays out. Obviously, Brazil's initial response was relatively muscular, assertive, saying we're going to defend ourselves and retaliate. privately, it's very likely they're going to try and approach the administration to negotiate. But what's also different about Trump's letter to the president of Brazil is that he didn't really offer an off-ramp in the same way all the other form letters do, noting the potential for negotiations in that August 1st deadline. Yeah. He seems to be laying it down as though this is what's going to happen.
Jenny, he also talked about the Brazilian Supreme Court's hundreds, this is a direct quote, hundreds of secret and unlawful censorship orders to U.S. social media platforms in his letter to President Lula da Silva. What's he talking about here? And is this, have we ever seen a crossover of personal attitude toward politics with trade policy like this?
I think what he might be referring to in part is if you remember some of the feud that happened between Elon Musk X in Brazil in the past. Okay. Now, that dispute was worked out separately. That could be part of what Trump is referring to here. It was obviously something that at the time he was paying pretty close attention to. And in terms of the use of tariffs and sort of advance what you might frame here as more a personal political issue, this is relatively unique. Obviously, we've seen him use tariffs towards other non-trade related policy concerns. For example, the fentanyl related tariffs geared towards China, concerns about the EU's regulatory issues, leveraging tariffs, in his words, to try and bring about peace between India and Pakistan. Of course, they would dispute that trade was part of those conversations. But all that is to say, Trump very clearly sees tariffs as a tool that he can use to achieve many different ends beyond the trade realm. However, this is a unique case where he seems to be leveraging it to try and influence domestic politics or what is seen within Brazil as a domestic political issue.
Well, we did hear back from Lula da Silva pretty quickly, actually, the response from the leader of Brazil saying that his nation will not be tutored, the word he used, by anyone, and that unilateral rate hikes will be responded to using Brazil's economic reciprocity law. So this is going pretty well so far. As we spend time with Jenny Welch, I want to ask you about Ukraine. Jenny, there is reporting today that weapons shipments from the U.S. have in fact resumed to Ukraine. And the news that's coming out of Ukraine has been horrifying, hit with a deadly attack once again, as allies gather in Rome to talk about post-war revival. I don't know how we can even advance the conversation to post-war when we can't get Vladimir Putin to stop bombing civilians. Jenny, what's going to happen here when the United States runs out of weapons that we continue to draw down from the Biden administration? By the end of the summer, they're going to need a new request, aren't they?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges here is, as you noted, there's one set of authorities that the Biden administration used called Presidential Drawdown Authority that allowed us to essentially ship Ukraine weapons right out of U.S. stocks. That authority has been largely used up. U.S. stocks, according to some in the Pentagon, are also severely depleted. And the challenge with that was the authority that allowed us to get stuff to Ukraine very quickly. There are other authorities that allow us to, for example, manufacture new weapons for Ukraine. And in fact, a lot of U.S. aid to Ukraine was in that form, allowing them to purchase U.S. weapons or for other partners to purchase U.S. weapons on behalf of Ukraine. But manufacturing those weapons takes a significant amount of time. There is a backlog in many U.S. customers who are waiting for some of the same systems that Ukraine is hoping to procure. This is the challenge that we've been facing for months to a year now. Europeans are trying to step up and fill in the gaps in U.S. assistance, but one of the key gaps that remains is on air defense and specifically the capability that U.S. Patriot defense batteries provide. That's one that's going to be really hard to find an alternative to, and that's one that can really make a huge difference in terms of defending, in particular, Ukrainian population centers and cities from Russian attacks.
Well, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, met today with Sergey Lavrov, his Russian counterpart. They met along the sidelines of the ASEAN foreign ministers meeting in Malaysia. Not great when you consider what he said coming out of this, Jenny. It was a frank conversation. It was an important one. It apparently did not advance the march to peace at all. We only have about 30 seconds. Is this administration helpless from a diplomatic standpoint right now?
I think the administration has a lot of options at their disposal. The key question is whether they want to use them, and sanctions being the key option that we haven't yet seen them willing to deploy in a stronger form against Russia.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, Jenny. We're going to talk later on this hour with our political panel about the advancement of a sanctions bill in the U.S. Senate written up by Lindsey Graham. John Thune says this could, in fact, head to the floor soon, and it looks like the president is about to lean into this. Jenny Welch, thank you so much, as always, with Bloomberg Economics, our geoeconomics analyst here.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm Kaylee Lines alongside Joe Matthew here in Washington, where we, of course, are keeping track of domestic developments and changes on that front. But changes in geopolitics as well, or at least changes in attitude, it seems, on the part of President Donald Trump when it comes to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. Of course, remembering he promised to end the war on day one of his presidency. Here we are in July with still no ceasefire agreement having been made, though his administration has been pushing for one. And he's expressed increasing frustration with the Russian President Vladimir Putin in that regard. So much so, in fact, that he actually reversed a decision made by his own Department of Defense, which was, of course, a pause of weapons, defensive weapons in particular, to Ukraine. That flow is now resuming on the president's orders. And it's something that the former number two to President Trump, at least during his first administration, former Vice President Mike Pence, is pretty happy about. He spoke earlier on Bloomberg Surveillance.
I was pleased that the president countermanded what had been a pause of aid to Ukraine last week, which I think was unfortunate. Wherever it originated, but I commend the president for reversing that decision. And my hope is when the Senate reconvenes that Senator Thune will put the Graham bill on the floor and put it on the president's desk. I think it's time.
Countermanded is an interesting word that Mike Pence uses there, and we want to bring this to an expert, a voice of experience. David Shimer spent time as the director of the National Security Council's Eastern Europe and Ukraine piece, director for Russian affairs in the Biden White House. He's now senior research scholar at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. Joining us from world headquarters in New York, David, it's great to have you on Bloomberg TV and radio. Bring us inside the bubble for this. Have you ever heard of an instance quite like this where the civilian leadership of the Pentagon acted without the approval of the commander in chief?
Great to be here. It's hard for me to comment from the outside on the precise decision making that's occurring on the inside. But what I can say is that when I was serving at the National Security Council, there was a robust interagency process where on a daily basis, decisions were being made on support for Ukraine at meetings that were chaired by the White House with participation from the Department of Defense, from State, from the intelligence community, and from others, such that coordination would take place and folks being overruled after the fact wouldn't actually have to occur. Whether that process is still taking place, I think, is in some doubt given the tumult and changeover at the National Security Council and elsewhere. And I do think that this is a reminder as to the value of having a robust, rigorous government decision-making process around issues as serious as these.
Well, so putting aside how exactly the initial decision was made, let's focus on the president's decision to reverse the initial decision, to resume the flow of aid to Ukraine, knowing that there was a time at which we thought that Ukraine did not necessarily have the explicit support of this particular president. What does it signal to you, David, that this reversal happened, what it means for the way in which the president may be looking at the conflict between Ukraine and Russia now versus before?
So I think it's certainly a good step to reverse whatever pause or decision had been made to halt aid to Ukraine, because Ukraine needs the support and it's in U.S. interest to provide Ukraine with the support. However, I also want to make clear that what was paused and has now been unpaused is aid that was authorized during the Biden administration, during the administration in which I was a part. And that was a drawdown package of $1.25 billion authorized in December of last year that has lasted up until this summer, as well as what's called USAI deliveries that were similarly contracted for last year. And the problem is that those deliveries are running out. And so even though the pause has been lifted, which again is a good step, What matters far more is whether this administration will go further and authorize additional new support for Ukraine, which will provide continued flows over time and enable Ukraine to continue to defend itself over time. And I very much believe that they should do that.
Well, that's a great point that you make here. So we're set to go through the end of summer, which is in about 5 minutes. You've actually gone through this process. Would the administration not have to submit an emergency supplemental request now to prevent a gap in weapons shipments? And what would you be asking for? Would these be defensive systems like Patriots or offensive ballistic missiles?
So as a side point, I struggle with the distinction in this context between defensive and offensive systems, because Ukraine is defending itself and Ukraine is now being provided Understood. With artillery and rockets to defend itself, that has been unpaused. And so I don't find that distinction especially useful. But taking a step back from that, I would also say that there is approximately $3.8 billion in drawdown authority that still remains available to the president of the United States to use without having to go to Congress. And so tomorrow, this administration could decide to draw down additional weapons from U.S. stockpiles for Ukraine without additional funding or authorization from the Congress, is point one. Point two is that the Europeans and the Ukrainians have said explicitly that they want to buy weapons from the United States to give to Ukraine. And so not only would we be furthering our support for Ukraine, there would also be additional generated revenue and trade inflows into the United States. That is another available option to the United States to get weapons to Ukraine. And so there are options to maintain our support beyond what was authorized in December. The question is whether those options will actually be executed upon.
Well, and when we consider the options that the administration has to exercise leverage or to try to influence the behavior of Russia specifically, I wonder what you make, David, of the sanctions package that it seems there is building momentum toward, at least in the United States Senate and possibly with the White House as well. What would this particular package of sanctions do that all of the other previous sanctions package, including the ones that, of course, were pursued by the Biden administration, do to alter the behavior of Vladimir Putin when he is still engaged in this war consistently throughout all of those sanctions being implemented?
So absolutely. I think if we just take a step back here, the reason that Ukraine has agreed to a ceasefire, but Russia has not, is because Russia and President Putin believe that time is on his side. He sees U.S. support as declining. He believes that the longer this war goes on, the more likely it is that his battlefield position will improve compared to Ukraine's. And so the objective in order to get to a ceasefire should be to affect Putin's calculus and make him believe the time is not on his side. And how do you do that? A, you continue and even surge weapons flows, as we just discussed. B, to your point, I believe that sanctions against Russia's energy sector should be intensified, built upon sanctions that have already been implemented, in order to increase the pressure on the Russian economy and make it more challenging for Russia to sustain its war of aggression. Third, something that we haven't yet discussed, is I believe that the Europeans should move towards seizing the approximately $300 billion in Russian sovereign assets that are immobilized in its jurisdictions in order to provide Ukraine with a long-term source of support, both to help Ukraine, but also to send a message to Russia that aid for Ukraine will not dry up with time. If you do those three things, surge weapons deliveries, intensify sanctions, and acquire a long-term source of assistance through the sovereign assets, that recipe could be enough to adjust Putin's thinking and to push him to the table in a meaningful way.
All right, David, great to have you here on Balance of Power. David Scheimer, former director for Russia at the National Security Council, in addition to former director for Eastern Europe and Ukraine at the National Security Council.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
In our Washington, D.C. studio, someone who is intimately familiar with this process as well, sitting on the Appropriations Committee in the House, Congressman Chuck Fleischmann is joining us, Republican representing Tennessee's 3rd District. Congressman, welcome back to Balance of Power. Always great to have you and nice to see you in studio.
Thank you.
Because you're here in studio, I could see you nodding along when Eric was suggesting it's going to be really hard to meet that September 30th deadline. You're betting on a continuing resolution.
Well, I'm an optimist. I'm okay. Always betting on a budget, but probably if you look at where things are, we never want to see a government shutdown. I've lived through three. It's not good. It costs more to reopen, and it just really is disadvantageous for the entire nation, including markets and the like. But what do I think will happen? I'm actually writing the energy and water bill for appropriations. Mm-hmm. We're going to mark that up next week in full committee. But the reality is you look at the clock and things like that, probably a short-term CR, he's right. We do not want a government shutdown. But the key thing to remember, and I try to tell my friends in my party this, it's going to take 60 votes in the Senate mm-hmm. to get an appropriations package, unlike reconciliation.
So will Republicans have a posture that involves Democrats in this process? What are you hearing from your colleagues across the aisle?
That's an interesting question. Right now, we're not receiving any help from Democrats. I can tell you with pretty certainty that my bill will pass out of my committee next week with all Republican votes. Now, when we go to the floor, that may be a different story. We have, obviously, three wonderful factions in our party. Our moderates are center-right. I'm in the center-right. And then our folks who are further to the right. So we've got to make sure that we hold our Republican votes together. But every once in a while, when we see increases, for example, in the Office of Science, which I'm going to put forth, in nuclear energy, and I'm getting tremendous bipartisan and bicameral support. Young progressives who agree with me on nothing come to me and support me on new nuclear. So we've got some things in some of these bills that are going to be attractive. I just don't know whether or not their leadership team in the House and in the Senate will allow them to do that. But the country does not want another continuing resolution. I don't think we've ever had two in a row. They're never good. They're preferable to a government shutdown, but they're never good. We need a budget.
Well, and so if getting Democrats on board with a budget is required here, to your point on needing 60 votes in the Senate, do you see the rescissions package currently being considered by the Senate as posing a danger to that bipartisan effort?
There's no question that it's less palatable to our friends in the Senate, both Republican and I think Democratic over there, largely Democrats. It will have a much easier time in the House. Remember, the rescission is rescinding, taking back money that's already been appropriated.
Which is why Democrats are saying, why would we make an appropriations deal with you if you can recant on it?
Indeed. But going forward, and again, the eternal optimist in me says, let's look forward. Let's get our budget done. The energy and water bill that I've written this year for the House is as strong as it was in 24. We passed it. It was great for energy, especially new nuclear. 25, we didn't get there. Why? Because of the continuing resolution. So the reality is you get out there, you put your best work product forward. The other cardinals, subcommittee chairs on appropriations, Republicans have written very good bills. Mm-hmm. We've passed some. Some are going to be very difficult to pass.
What do you think about the Mike Rounds of the world who worry about eliminating funding for NPR? And I ask you this because, you know, I believe it was Bill Cassidy said last evening, a senator from Louisiana, we've got to cut the funding because it's a partisan operation. But there are some lawmakers like Senator Rounds who say this is a lifeline for people in rural areas. You might not like what's on the NPR network, but these local newsrooms are delivering critical emergency information. Does he have a point?
Well, he has a vote. I don't know if he has a point, but he has a vote. And I have heard that rhetoric coming from some of my Republican colleagues. Yeah. And prior to this discourse, I never did understand or know that that dynamic was out there. They feel that that is a lifeline to many areas in rural America. Mm-hmm. So if a senator particularly feels that strongly about it, it is going to have to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Again, there's not always an equal weight between the House and the Senate. One senator can really derail or stop a process. Mm-hmm. So we have to listen to that. However, we need to see strong reforms. I think at NPR, there are things that are done there that really need to be addressed. I would like to see more of a political balance like we do on your great show. We've got to listen to both sides and let the American people then make their decisions. But I come from the right. Others come from the left or the center. But the reality is we need balance.
Well, as Joe makes the point about the role of public notification, especially in these rural areas, that brings me to a question around emergency response, given what we've just seen play out in Texas, yes. What frankly is still unfolding before our eyes with so many people remaining missing in Hill Country. Tennessee is obviously no stranger to natural disasters either. And I'm wondering if you're learning lessons about the way in which information was distributed, if it's too early to have those conversations as this still is an active rescue effort, and the conversation around reforms to FEMA as well, as this teaching us that you still need to have the federal response able to be put into place.
You raise an excellent point. Anytime we have a national disaster, whether it's in Tennessee or anywhere across the great United States, there's sadness, there's disaster, there's tragedy, there's sadly loss of life and the like. after the event, we can learn from these events. Sometimes how to predict these. We've seen Doppler radars and things put in my state over the years to watch hurricanes and watch tornadoes. There's a lot of tornadoes in Tennessee that touch down. These flooding incidents were horrific. The one in Texas is of a magnitude I don't think that we've seen in a long time. It's really, really horrible. FEMA will be looked at. Obviously, I know Kristi Noem very well. I actually came into Congress with Secretary Noem. Wonderful lady. She'll do a great job. I think President Trump will do a good job. But I think the American people want to see reform. They want to see these largest federal organizations, agencies that have just really year after year just had bigger budgets, bloated budgets, and have not really spent wisely. I think if we start to spend our money more wisely, they need to be funded. I don't think you'll see FEMA go away, but I think you're going to see a reformed, stronger FEMA, as well as other federal organizations that are going to be more responsive to their ultimate constituents.
Well, this event in Texas also reminds us of the improvements needed to the grid, the electric grid that we talk to you about a lot, hardening the grid as well. We just saw the president's big, beautiful bill pass. You were part of the celebration, of course, and we saw watering down of incentives for solar and wind. Did this bill do enough to secure nuclear, which is one of your most passionate issues?
Thank you. Yes, it did a lot for nuclear. At first, we were very concerned. I was very concerned, as was our very good Secretary of Energy, Chris Wright, wonderful man, doing a good job, about the nuclear tax credits. Excuse the pun, nuclear is hot right now. There's a lot of private investment. Markets are moving towards investing a lot of capital, and that was not the case 5 or 10 years ago. New nuclear is so important. Big nuclear is important. I mean, the larger nuclear power plants. We're seeing Three Mile Island reopened. We're going to see a power plant in Michigan, an older one, opened. We had Vogtle in Georgia. So we're going to have small, mid-size, and larger nuclear power plants. It's reliable. It's resilient. But yes, the big, beautiful bill was very good for nuclear. I don't think it was as disadvantageous to some of the things as solar or some of the people think it will be. Solar, I think, is here to stay, but it's got to find its place in the market. Wind has problems. Wind has major, major problems. But ultimately, we're going to see natural gas come back very strong. I think it's a very good bridge fuel. We're seeing TVA, my utility, building more gas as we get to nuclear. Nuclear is incredible, but new nuclear right now is going to take a lot of capital to build the first of a kinds. But when you build the 10th and the 100th, it will drop down in costs. But the nuclear industry in America is booming in every way.
Well, and when we consider the role nuclear may have in powering artificial intelligence and data centers going forward, to get that power to a data center, to allow the data center and the data centers being built to allow that to happen, you need copper for a lot of that transit. Yes. And the president says effective August 1st, there's going to be a 50% tariff on copper. Do you worry about the potential ramifications of that, knowing that by and large, it does not seem we have adequate supply to meet the kind of demand that we are expected to see?
We're going to wait and see where the president goes with copper, but you're absolutely right. Not only copper, but there's other metals and minerals that are important for this process. It's one of the reasons I support our national labs through the Office of Science. I think I have the best in the country at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Oak Ridge. But the reality is our labs are looking at ways to use other products. Unfortunately, the Chinese have about a 90% share of this market. They control a lot of this market. We've allowed that to happen. As we regain some of that control with existing rare earths and things like that, it's important. But the reality is maybe we can use our labs to go out and find alternates that are more reliable, less expensive, more resilient. And that's part of our great national research that I don't think any other country, even the Chinese, can match.
We actually spent some time with a young nuclear entrepreneur who was at the White House a couple of weeks ago to talk about the future of this technology. The governor of Utah joined him on the air to talk about their project together. How quickly will we see these small modular nuclear reactors being permitted for use? I realize a big nuke plant is another matter, but these small modular reactors could be something that we see much sooner.
Well, fortunately, in the great state of Tennessee, with our great utility, the Tennessee Valley Authority, we actually have a permitted site at Clinch River. And that would be for an SMR, a small modular reactor with less output. They're smaller to build. They're easier to license. They've chosen a GE Hitachi model, which basically uses the existing fuel supply. Mm-hmm. So when you talk SMRs, you have to say, what would the SMR of today look like? And then maybe the SMR in 5 or 10 years. The reason for the other SMRs, we have very good designs out there, TerraPower, X Energy, mm-hmm. but they require a higher fuel. It's called HALEU. And actually, sadly, Russia produces a lot of HALEU. Huh. There's going to be a ban on that in 2028. But that's why I've worked so hard in fiscal 2024 to put up $2.7 billion so that the United States could then begin to have HALEU and LEU. Of course, we have LEU as an existing fuel, but we want to start enriching uranium domestically again. Think about it. Mm-hmm. We're the birthplace of the Manhattan Project. We started this technology, and we've let it basically wither away. America is coming back, so we have American companies doing it. We're attracting other foreign countries to this. Urenco and Orano are in the space, but Centris is an American company doing this. So that is the fuel end of that. But right now, to get one built, we need to use, in my view, existing fuel supply, LEU, that they're using in the big plants, mm-hmm. and designs that work. So Tennessee will lead in this regard. Utah will also be leading, and our friends in Idaho. I can't leave them out.
Well, on the subject of Tennessee, knowing that, of course, you're fresh off of the effort to pass the One Big Beautiful Bill, yes. What impact are you expecting in Tennessee of the changes that were made in that bill to the way in which Medicaid benefits can be accessed and distributed? Who qualifies for them? What are you preparing your constituents for?
It's another great question. I just returned from home. I flew up this morning from Chattanooga. So I've been here in Chattanooga the past few days. I came up to have dinner with our great speaker, Mike Johnson, tonight. Most of my constituents, not all, everywhere I went, in rural America, very, very strong for the Big Beautiful Bill. No question about that. In Oak Ridge, I went up there, the same situation. The few Democrats I ran into, candidly, and my district is ruby red, but I represent all my constituents, and I'm very cognizant of that. Mm-hmm. Just as I tell friends of mine who are Republicans in Massachusetts and in blue states, their voice needs to be heard, too. We're all mm-hmm. Americans. The Democrats in the district are livid. They do not like this bill. The Republicans and independents I spoke with, very, very positive about that. Why? Number one, we raised the debt limit. That does not get talked about much. We mm-hmm. raised it by $5 trillion. Why is that important? We were on the verge of a default. Yep. And give President Trump good credit. When he was talking to the members about why we needed to pass this thing, that was the sleeper that most people don't want to lead with. That's not your best card that you want to play with the American people, especially in our party. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the strongest calls I'll get at our office when on the precipice of a raising the national debt. But they said, like, no, don't do it. Don't do it. We can never go into default. Yeah. So that mm-hmm. was done. The tax situation is something that's going to impact most people. No tax on tips. I eat out a lot. The servers are happy. but overwhelmingly, where I live, it's not a hard sell. In bluer states, it's going to be a hard sell or a no sell.
Congressman, it's great to see you. Tell the speaker we'd love for him to join our conversation next time you come to see us.
Yes, sir.
I should let everyone know. Well, we like visiting with you. You're writing books now. This is a novel, Once Upon an Empire by Chuck Fleischman. Kaylee, the review on the cover is from Kevin McCarthy, a former speaker of the House of Representatives.
And he
congrats on the new book.
And I got a wonderful letter from Donald Trump. He read it and liked it. It's political fiction. Okay. I promise all my works are works of fiction.
Yeah.
So it's time to make America think again.
We're going to stick with the facts here for now. Congressman, great to see you.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
As we add the voice of Senator Shelley Moore Capito, another Republican member here with the idea of rescissions coming up very quickly here from West Virginia. Senator, it's great to see you back on Bloomberg TV and radio. We were just discussing this $9 billion plus rescissions package. Will it pass?
Well, I think we're going to be considering it next week. We are now looking at the details of the rescission package. It's a $9 billion package, mostly USAID, but also Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And we have some, we may make some adjustments there in terms of where we think this may be, may have gone too far in some cases. And so we're in the process of that right now.
Well, and will the end result of that process, Senator, risk being that Democrats do not find themselves ultra willing for a bipartisan compromise on appropriations, on keeping the government funded beyond September 30th, because they know there's always a risk that funding gets rescinded?
Well, I think that the Democrats are certainly making that argument. I think basically the overwhelming opinion across the country and what President Trump campaigned on is that the USAID money, much of it, and this is not cutting all of it, of course, but much of it is used for ways that are really not benefiting global health and others that it's advertised for. And also the fact that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, particularly on the NPR side, has for years been very much a left-leaning organization. And why are we using our taxpayer dollars for this? So these are pretty well-defined areas that the president talked about. So the Democrats shouldn't be surprised by this. We are in appropriations. I just came from my appropriations meeting. It could be a rocky road here, but we did pass two bills out of committee, so there's a plus.
We would love to hear a little bit more about that, but I'd also like to ask you first about the president's big, beautiful bill. Senator, I saw some local reporting from West Virginia that you were met by a small band of protesters at not a town hall, but a ribbon cutting event in Fayetteville your home state. Do you have any buyer's remorse for this bill, concerns about changes to Medicaid, or will you tell us that these were Democratic activists and this is the cost of doing business?
Well, you know what? I stopped and talked. We talked 10, 15 minutes before the event. It was opening up a really beautiful bike trail in Fayetteville, West Virginia. So I'd invite visitors to visit it. And, you know, I tried to talk about the facts of the bill. The facts of the bill is every West Virginia taxpayer will not see their taxes go up. Their taxes will actually go down because we increase the standard deduction. We also provide seniors with a tax break, those that are relying on Social Security, no taxes on tips, no taxes on overtime. So this is an important for West Virginia. Their main focus was, as you would expect, Medicaid. And basically what I tried to tell them and what I believe and why I do not have buyer's remorse is that I believe in order to preserve Medicaid for future generations, we got to get people off of it that don't deserve to be there, that we have to bend the curve in spending, and we will be spending $200 billion over 10 years, just not a trillion. And I really think able-bodied people being able to work some for their benefits. In my view, these are not unreasonable asks. And the thing I'm concerned about is, are these programs going to be there in 10, 20 years? And at the rate of growth, the answer is no. So we need to make sure that this is going to the people that it's intended for and serves their health needs the best. The Rural Stabilization Fund is big in my state because obviously we're very rural in West Virginia. And I think this will help our hospitals that have issues, are going to have some issues with affordability.
Well, and that stabilization fund to the tune, of course, of $50 billion. Do you expect, Senator, that to be adequate, not knowing it's not just West Virginia that is going to need the assistance, but states across the country? Or could there need be a need that arises for further subsidies for those hospitals?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind, too, that the changes were made on the provider tax and other things on Medicaid don't go into effect for 3 years. So we've got time to adjust here if, in fact, what you're saying is true. I think what we're going to see is our rural hospitals stronger because they're going to run more efficiently. There's going to be ways through CMS and others to make sure that IT systems and everything are better coordinated. I have confidence that rural health care and rural health care delivery is very difficult, and we've got to preserve every avenue, and that means preserving all the rural hospitals in my state and across the country.
We talked a lot, Senator, about the cuts to subsidies for clean energy. We were just discussing wind and solar with Congressman Chuck Fleischman. What does that mean for West Virginia, and will it create a demand for more coal?
Well, I think what it does is it evens the playing field for every resource or every source of energy supply. It also, I think, boosts nuclear energy. We have all this energy demand through AI and data centers. We can't meet the demand, so we need baseload baseload energy, which wind and solar do not provide. It's ephemeral. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. We need that baseload, so that's natural gas, coal, nuclear. And there's a hydrogen piece in there that's particularly of interest to me. I asked to move the deadline out just a little bit to see if we can jumpstart a lot of these projects, and I was successful with that. So I think it really just evens the playing field for all energy, all types of energy. And I think it'll be good for my state because we're an energy state.
Senator, I'd like to go back to the subject of appropriations in your seat on the committee. Congressman Fleischman also just told us that he's expecting a short-term continuing resolution is likely going to be required to keep the government funded beyond the end of the fiscal year. Is that also your expectation?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't have to make that decision until the end of September. The leader Thune, has said with our chair, Chair Collins, and Vice Chair Murray, that we want to have these bills up on the floor. Let's give that a chance to work. I mean, we're running out of time. We only have 7 weeks, but we do have 7 weeks. So hopefully we can have some successes there before I make the declaration that we have to have a continuing resolution. I'd rather see us keep this process moving as much as we can.
All right. Senator, we appreciate your time joining us live from Capitol Hill. Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia here with us on Bloomberg TV and radio. Thank you so much. And we want to continue the conversation now as we turn here to our political panel. Rick Davis is with us, Bloomberg politics contributor, Republican strategist and Stone Court Capitol partner, alongside Arshi Siddiqui, former senior aide to former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, now founder and CEO of Bellwether Government Affairs. Welcome to you both. Arshi, to begin with you, we were just speaking with both the senator and the congressman about this notion that Democrats may not have much incentive to make a spending deal with Republicans that are pursuing at the same time rescissions of previously appropriated spending by Congress. We know Nancy Pelosi wasn't afraid to hold a firm line on spending-oriented deals and shutdowns when she needed to. What do you expect to happen here as we approach the end of the fiscal year?
I mean, I think your question was spot on, because the rescissions discussion is going to be critical in terms of paving the future, in terms of not only the continuing resolution, appropriations, et cetera. And as you know, in the Senate, has traditionally been very bipartisan. And this rescissions bill, they're talking about changes. And the question is, are they bringing in Democrats? Are they, because, you know, to your point, if you can't rely on a deal that's made, and we've already seen Republicans go back on these types of deals. So I think particularly after this past reconciliation bill, I think it's going to set the tone for the rest of the year.
Rick, would it behoove Republicans to step away from the rescissions plan in hopes of actually clearing a budget before the end of the fiscal year?
I'd love to tell you that I'm enthusiastic that we could get to regular order and pass 12 appropriations bills before the end of September, but I've given up. You know, mark this day in your calendar. Rick Davis doesn't think the Senate
it's
can actually
taken
get
this long.
He's thrown in the towel.
Yeah. So look, I think that the Senate may crater the rescissions package on its own. Right. There are lots of senators concerned about PEPFAR getting stricken, and rural radio, as you mentioned in your last interview, has become a real big issue for people like Senator Rounds and Senator Sullivan. So that may die on its own accord. That being said, whether or not the Senate can actually produce appropriations bills on time, my guess is Thune has a plan to do a continuing resolution. He'll continue the public attitude that we want to do our business. But of course, there's never been anybody fired from a chairmanship because they didn't get the appropriations done. So at the end of the day, count me as skeptical.
Well, when we consider what the Senate Majority Leader might have up his sleeve, it's also a question of the Minority Leader, of Hakeem Jeffries in the House. How should we be thinking about the Democratic calculus here as to whether or not they want to play hardball on this issue, risk a shutdown, how that plays for them politically? I just wonder what kind of leverage they're really working with.
I mean, traditionally, Democrats have always put government first in terms of that continuity. So I think we have seen that quite a bit. But I do think that there is a tried and true blueprint of bipartisan, bicameral negotiations on these packages. I mean, time and time again. I think we're in an aberration in terms of moving away from that in this past negotiation. And, you know, the reconciliation bill, when you have one party control, that is usually given that, you know, when you have the House, White House and Senate. Sure. But on the appropriations packages and year end packages, those have generally been bipartisan. And that's a give and take. So I think that's both sides. I mean, so far, the Republicans have not been willing to do that give and take. But I do think that Democrats are going to drive a hard bargain. And but again, I think the rescissions package will pave that way.
Hakeem Jeffries has a very different style than Nancy Pelosi
Absolutely.
Did.
Yes.
What would your former boss have been doing right now? Because I feel like she would have been screaming from the rooftops about this. Hakeem Jeffries has a much more subtle approach. How loud does he need to get about rescissions?
So I think Hakeem Jeffries needs to be Hakeem Jeffries.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're in a different era. There's generational shift. I talk to a lot of members of Congress. There's a lot of support for Jeffries. He's very thoughtful. He's very smart. He really does try to put country first. So I think it's a different style. So I don't think we should, that shouldn't be the template. He's also can be very tough. I mean, he's a tough politician. He
sure.
comes from New York.
And I'm not questioning that, yes, but sometimes yes. you need to put this on Front Street so people know about it.
Absolutely. And you saw him on the floor. I think that was a shining moment for mm-hmm. Jeffries, right? Like the leader was on the floor for 8+ hours. He broke the record. So I think from that perspective, I think Democrats are very united against this bill because it really represents, it's not the usual tax bill that we've seen in the past. It's an ideological bill in many respects. So I think that's going to serve as the blueprint for Jeffries going forward.
Well, Democrats may not like the bill, but it's the bill that the president wanted, Rick, and it's the bill the president ultimately got. To the point you were making a few minutes ago about you think the Senate might ultimately end this rescissions effort all on its own, how is that going to sit with Donald Trump, do you expect?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When a bill was first submitted, there wasn't really a strong commitment by the White House. They said things like, well, you know, we've got more we can send if this one goes through, you know, kind of raising the question that, like, how committed are you to really drive this through? And so, you know, I think this is actually, you know, sort of ball in the Senate court. It's really up to them to decide whether or not they want to see another $100 billion of rescissions coming from the White House, because if this doesn't pass, it's highly likely to raise questions inside the White House whether this is a good commitment of their time and effort, you know, with Congress. They've got a lot of agenda items that they need to get through Congress, and rescission packages have historically never fared well. And in this case, especially when you think you have a backlog of hundreds of billions of dollars of more rescissions to come, you know, does Congress really want to get in that business? I mean, these are very difficult votes for some of these members. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how many times are you going to ask them to walk the plank?
Mm-hmm. Just have 30 seconds, Archie. If this doesn't pass, is this the last vestige of the DOGE?
Well, I think what's interesting about the DOGE is that there's supposed to be $2 trillion in cuts. And
yeah,
as we know, this rescission bill is $9 billion in change. So I think that speaks for a lot.
Bit of a delta there. Yeah.
A little different. Yes, indeed. Archie, thanks for joining our panel. We'd love to have you back mm-hmm. as soon as we can. Archie Siddiqui and Rick Davis with a smart conversation you'll only hear on Balance of Power. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.